And this evening we look at that chapter that we just read, chapter 18, and also chapter 19. And I suppose we could sum up these chapters in the well-known words in chapter 19. I know that my Redeemer liveth. I know that my Redeemer liveth. But first of all, in chapter 18, Bildad spelled it out again. Bildad spelled it out again. Bildad is the blunt talker. He was extremely blunt in his first speech, and he is even more blunt in this one. He's verbally the hatchet man who is not afraid to confront Job as he imagines to be necessary. So first of all, he tells Job that he is loud-mouthed, that he is a loud-mouthed. Verse 2, how long will it be ere ye make an end of words? Mark, and afterwards we will speak. It uses the plural, ye, rather than thou. Some have thought this is because Bildad is addressing the other men, the other friends, but more probable is that the plural was used in addressing someone of great standing and dignity, and he's using it somewhat sarcastically of Job, that he's addressing Job as someone excellent in a cynical and sarcastic vein. And what he's saying is, mark, that is, let us know when you've finished, and afterwards we will speak. I think that's the sense of verse 2. So it's a very sarcastic comment. He's saying to Job, you're such a great one, when will your words finish? Let us know, and then we'll say something. And then in verse 3, he's telling Job, you insulted us, wherefore are we counted as beasts and reputed vile in your sight? And then in verse 4, he's saying that Job is in a rage and that he is self-important. He's saying that Job expects the world to be turned on its head just for his benefit. As if God must alter his laws of operation for Job's sake. He teareth himself in his anger. Shall the earth be forsaken for thee? And shall the rock be removed out of his place? He's saying, you think everything should change just for you. But what's happening to you is a normal mode of God's acting, and it won't change. As you can see, this is fairly biting stuff. He's saying, you expect everything to be altered to justify you. And then, in verse 5, right to the end of the chapter, we have a homily, or a tirade, on the dwelling of the wicked. He's describing the dwelling of the wicked. Not that there isn't truth in it, but Bildad means this to be a description of what is happening to Job. And so he uses various illustrations in verses 5 and 6. Job is like a lamp that is put out. All his posterity is like a lamp that is soon snuffed out. You may remember that Job confessed himself that he felt he was in darkness in verse 12 of the previous chapter. Well, Bildad isn't slow to pick that up and to say that the wicked are like a lamp. I think the idea is one of these hanging lamps from the ceiling that you snuff out. And he's saying that describes the wicked and, by implication, Job. Then in verse 7, he's saying that the wicked is like an athlete who is reduced to a shuffling old man. Say there, the steps of his strength shall be straightened, or the vigor of his steps will be weakened, and his own counsel shall cast him down. It's the idea that the wicked man, who had been strong and vigorous, suddenly becomes like a poor old man who can hardly get along. He's like an animal quickly ensnared, verses 8 to 10. Various terms are used, the net, the snare, the gin, one attacked by the robber, the snare again, the trap in verse 10. The idea is that the ruin of the wicked man is sure, it's sudden, it comes quickly, and there's no escape. And then verse 11 to 14, he dwells upon disease and death. Disease and death. Verse 11, terror shall make him afraid on every side, and shall drive him to his feet, or pursue him, like someone pursuing on their feet, or causing someone to run ahead of them. And it's the idea of terror of conscience. And then in verse 12, impending disaster, his strength shall be hunger bitten, and destruction shall be ready at his side. And in verse 13, it's a beginning of a description of illness. It shall devour the strength of his skin. Even the firstborn of death shall devour his strength. The firstborn of death here is disease and illness. And it goes on, his confidence shall be rooted out of his tabernacle, and it shall bring him to the king of terrors. The idea is that that illness is the firstborn of death, and is sent ahead to summon the wicked, who is escorted and arrested by illness and brought before the king of terrors, which is death itself. And so his confidence shall be rooted out of his tabernacle, because he's hauled out of his tabernacle to appear before death, the king of terrors. And so then his very dwelling is destroyed. Verse 15, it shall dwell in his tabernacle, because it is none of his. Brimstone shall be scattered upon his habitation. So here Bildad is saying the wicked man, terrors of conscience pursue him. He's in danger every moment. Illness devours his skin. And of course there's a pretty pointed reference to Job himself here. And illness is the arresting officer to bring him to death, the king of terrors. And his tabernacle, his tent, is empty, and brimstone falls upon it, and he's utterly blotted out. And so verse 16, root and branch are destroyed. His roots shall be dried up beneath, and above shall his branch be cut off. And then in verse 16 to 20, it's saying that the wicked man, when he's gone, he's forgotten. There's no dwelling. His dwelling is forgotten, verse 17 to 18. Nothing is named after him. His name is forgotten in the street. And he's driven from light into darkness, chased out of the world. And what is more, in verse 19, he has no family, no son, nor nephew. The word nephew can also be rendered grandson among his people, nor any remaining in his dwelling. Note there again the reference to Job, who now has lost his family. And the Bildad is saying this is part of God's judgment on the wicked, that he's left without remembrance in the earth. And so he causes only astonishment. They that come after him shall be astonished at his day, as they that went before were affrighted. People were frightened of him, and they're astonished at him when he's gone. And verse 21, this is the dwelling of the wicked. And what Bildad is saying, this is what it's like for the wicked, Job. And Job, it's happening to you now. Your children are gone, your dwelling is gone, your health is gone, death's coming because you're wicked. We have to admit that Bildad certainly doesn't beat about the bush, and he's telling Job very plainly, but he's wrong. wasn't wicked. He was a godly man. Back to chapter 1. We pause here for some lessons. First of all, Bildad had nothing new to say, but he said it anyway. We saw that with Eliphaz, that Eliphaz really hadn't anything new much to say, but he said it anyway. So does Bildad. And he would have been better saying nothing, of course. But then secondly, to speak our minds is not enough. I wonder how many people you've heard saying, I like to speak my mind. And they say, I like to speak my mind, there's no beating about the bush. You get what I think. And sometimes people say that, and sometimes it's not true, of course, when they say that. But sometimes, even when it is true, they feel that that vindicates all that they say. That because they speak their minds, that means they are blameless. And people do say that. I'm sure you've come across it. I certainly have. They say, I like to speak my mind. And they feel that that vindicates them from all fault, provided what is in their mind is what comes out of their mouth. But that isn't the only requirement of speech, is it? For one thing, what we think can be wrong and wicked. If what we think and what comes out is not the result of careful, biblically governed thought, then it would be better not coming out. We should think before we speak, and we should make sure that what we're going to say is not sinful, that what we're thinking is not sinful. We shouldn't add the sin of thought to the sin of speech. We are responsible for what is in our mind. We are responsible also for the right use of what was in our mind. Some of what Bildad said was plain wrong, and some of it was misapplied, and some of it, even if true, would have been better unsaid in this situation. It is not our responsibility to say everything we know in every situation. There is such a thing as a time and a place. Sometimes we do have to hurt people because they must be told what is true. But to hurt people unnecessarily by our speech, even when compatible with truthfulness, is still sinful. To hurt people when it is not in their in the interest of their ultimate good and welfare is sinful. So the point I'm making here is that to blatter out everything in our minds willy-nilly, whilst often in this part of the world hailed as a great virtue, it isn't. It doesn't glorify God. Certainly, deception and cowardice and slandering behind backs on that is wrong. But it is not a virtue always to say everything that is in our minds. It has to be sifted as to its truthfulness, its accuracy, and its usefulness in the given situation. Bildad was forthright, but he was wrong in content and destructive in tendency. But then, is Bildad insecure? He's getting stronger and stronger in his denunciation of Job. His theory of swift justice was important to him. You see, if his theory of swift justice was true, then not only did Job's suffering show that Job was wicked, but Bildad's lack of suffering showed that he was righteous. So Bildad had a lot invested in this theory. He wasn't suffering. Things were going well for Bildad. Perhaps they had for quite some time. And so it wasn't only that he wanted to believe that Job was wicked, because he also wanted to believe that he was righteous. And so the idea that outward prosperity, health and wealth are an indication of righteousness or wickedness, pretty much on the spot indication, was important to Bildad. Because if Job suffered when he was godly, then Bildad could be prosperous and wicked. And so Bildad didn't want to consider the possibility that his prosperity was compatible with his being wicked. And so it was essential to believe in Bildad's mind that Job was wicked. Because if Job wasn't wicked, his whole theory collapsed, and he'd have to start asking about himself. And perhaps he wasn't really totally convinced that Job was wicked. There's an uneasiness about Bildad. Does his bluntness and forthrightness perhaps express a certain uneasiness that he wants to get this thing sorted out quickly, and Job must admit it because it's making him feel a little uneasy? And that explains perhaps his vehemence. Well, moving on to the second part, Job declares his rejection in chapter 19, verses 1 to 20. He's rejected by his friends in verse 2 to 6. Their speech crushed him. Verse 2, how long will ye vex my soul and break me in pieces with words? And then verse 3, these 10 times have ye reproached me. Not literally, but I'm sure to Job it seemed as though they'd been at it for a long time. You're not ashamed that you make yourself strange to me. He felt worn down by their harshness and their remoteness. Believers must be tender-hearted, easily entreated. These men were hard. There's nothing spiritual courage and fortitude and an uncompromising spirit have nothing to do with the harsh severity that these men displayed. There is nothing incompatible between being utterly uncompromising in principle and being kind and tender-hearted. And it is a perversion of biblical truth to make boldness for the truth, even if it was the truth, it wasn't in their case, but to make boldness an excuse for undue severity and heartlessness. And then verse 4 to 6, Job, we read, and be it indeed that I have erred, mine error remaineth with myself. If indeed ye will magnify yourselves against me and plead against me my reproach, know now that God hath overthrown me and hath compassed me with his net. And Job is here saying, any sin of mine hasn't affected you. It's with me, it's in my dwelling, and it's God who's touching me, it's God who's afflicting me. It doesn't give you the right to rail against me. I haven't done anything to you. And so you've no right to make it worse. God is sovereign. He has the right to afflict me, but you don't. My sin is with me, and God is dealing with me, but you have no right to deal with me in this way, because I haven't sinned against you. Then he speaks of being rejected by God. In verse 6, he says he has compassed me with his net. In verse 7, he's like a man who's been set upon and crying out for help, but no one comes. I cry out of wrong or violence, but I am not heard. I cry aloud, but there is no judgment. Like a man being mugged, and crying out, and no one comes. And then in verse 8, he's like a man hemmed in at night, fenced up my way that I cannot pass, and he has set darkness in my path. He's a man enclosed, he can't find his way out, he's in the dark. He's like a humiliated and conquered king. Verse 9, he has stripped me of my glory and taken the crown from my head. He's like an uprooted and therefore hopeless tree. In verse 10, he hath destroyed me on every side, and I am gone, and my hope hath he removed like a tree. Compare chapter 14, verse 7 to 9, where it talks about the stump being left, but not now. It's the whole tree removed. And then he's like one man against a host of men. Verse 11, he hath also kindled his wrath against me, and he counteth me up unto him as one of his enemies. His troops come together and raise up their way against me and camp round about my tabernacle. And then he's being rejected by household and by society. Verse 13, my brethren. Verse 14, my kinsfolk, my familiar friends, close friends. Verse 15, they that dwell in mine house, and my maids count me a stranger. I am an alien in their sight. I called my servant, and he gave me no answer. I entreated him with my mouth. Those who he used to be in charge of ignore him. Verse 17, my breath is strange to my wife. In other words, because of his ailments, his breath stank, and his wife, who should have shown loyalty, notwithstanding the unpleasantness, she wouldn't put up with it. Though I entreated for the children's sake of mine own body, which may well mean, though I entreated her to remember the marriage union and the family we had as a result of it, and looking back on the former days, and where now she doesn't want to know him. Or it could possibly mean, I entreated the children of my mother's womb. It is possible that he's referring to his brothers in that verse. And then verse 18, yea, young children, or it can be wicked children, despise me. I arose and they spake against me. Even children despise Job now. Job had been such a powerful man, now even the children despise him. All my inward friends, the men of my secret in the margin, abhorred me. Those that were close friends, those that he confided in and who confided in him, now they turned against him. And then verse 20, he returns to his physical condition. My bone cleaveth to my skin and to my flesh, and I am escaped with the skin of my teeth. That phrase, the skin of my teeth, we always use it, don't we, to mean narrowly escaping with our lives. But it may be that what he's saying is the skin of his teeth is all that's left, as if he's lost his teeth. And so he's rejected and he's ill and in a dreadful condition. And so he says, verse 21, have pity upon me, have pity upon me, O ye my friends, for the hand of God hath touched me. Why do ye persecute me as God and are not satisfied with my flesh? Why are you not satisfied that I'm physically wrecked without adding to it by your word? There's something pathetic about Job. He just wants some sympathy, some compassion, some love, some kindness. And so thirdly, Job professes faith. Job professes faith. Verse 23 to the end. These contain the best known verses of the book, I'm sure. First of all, Job desires a permanent record of what he said. Verse 23, oh, that my words were now written, oh, that they were printed in a book. And then he goes further, that they were graven with an iron pen and lead in the rock forever, that they were chiseled out of the rock and lead put in the where they'd be chiseled out, so that they'd be there to stand the test of time, so that when he is vindicated, then these words will show that what he was saying was true. He wants what he's saying to be kept on permanent record, and When the day comes, then he will be seen to have been speaking the truth. And then he expresses the confidence that vindication will come. For I know that my Redeemer liveth, and that he shall stand at the latter day upon the earth. And though after my skin worms destroy this body, yet in my flesh shall I see God, whom I shall see for myself, and mine eyes shall behold and not another, though my reins be consumed within me. The Redeemer, the Vindicator, the Goel. In the Old Testament, the word is Goel, and it's used of that relation who had obligations towards his relative. In the Old Testament, he was the Goel, the near kinsman, was obliged to do certain things. He was obliged to buy back the family inheritance, to redeem, to buy back his kinsman from slavery, to marry the childless widow, to provide an heir for the one departed, or to avenge the death of a murdered relative. In other words, the Goel, the Redeemer or the Vindicator, was the one who looked after the name and the standing and the reputation of another, a vindicator. He looked after his cause. And so here Job records his conviction. There is a vindicator who will own him as his. There is one who will vindicate his cause, one who will take up his cause, one who will represent his cause, one who will act on his behalf. And he's already said this earlier on in chapter 16 and verse 19. And now behold, my witness is in heaven, and my record is on high. And verse 21, oh, that one might plead for a man with God, as a man pleadeth for his neighbor. But now it's more emphatic and explicit. And we know that in the full light of the New Testament, the Lord Jesus Christ will own his people before the Father and before the holy angels. Who shall lay anything to the charge of God's elect? Christ that died, yea, rather that is risen again, who also maketh intercession for us. And Job refers to the time that he expects this, the latter day, or the latter, in the end, at the end. Job expects this to happen. Now some people apply this to the present life. They say Job anticipated what would happen at the end of the book, that the Lord would vindicate Job on the earth. But that's forced, because you see, Job didn't expect to live. We've seen that. He's really given up hope as far as this life is concerned. And he's speaking about the end of the world. And his vindicator would stand on the earth. The word earth literally is dust, and it would seem to refer to the earth in the sense of the receptacle of the human body that goes down to the grave. And his vindicator would stand upon the earth, and Job will see God in a resurrected body. Verse 26, and though after my skin worms destroy this body. Now you see that our translation has certain words in italics, but certainly he believed that his skin was almost all that was left on his bones. Even though that were destroyed in death, yet in my flesh shall I see God. He would see God, and he would see God in peace, and he would see God in a body, a resurrection body. And he would see God in peace because he had a vindicator on high. And again, carrying forward into the New Testament, we know that the believers shall be raised to glory, and that this vile body shall be made like unto Christ's glorious body, and this corruptible shall put on incorruption. And at the end of verse 27, though my veins, the word though isn't essential, my veins be consumed within me, it's the idea of a consuming desire for that day when he will be vindicated by the Lord Jesus Christ. How clearly Job understood, we don't know, we've said that before, but it's the Lord Jesus Christ who would own him as his. For I know whom I have believed, and am persuaded that he is able to keep that which I have committed unto him against that day. And so Job here boldly professes the faith. We may find it puzzling that Job can be so pessimistic and then so bold in profession, but I don't think that should puzzle us at all. People in extremity of suffering do fluctuate greatly, and that's true of the people of God also. And so in the last two verses, but ye should say, why persecute we him, seeing the root of the matter is found in me? He's saying they should stop persecuting him, because the root of the matter, faith and godliness, is in him. He's not a hypocrite. He's not the wicked man they're making out. So they should stop. And he goes on to give another reason. Verse 29. Be ye afraid of the sword, for wrath bringeth the punishments of the sword, that ye may know there is a judgment. Their anger against him, their persecution of him, they need to watch out. He's saying, I have a vindicator with God, so you watch out. Because if I have a vindicator with God and you persecute me, what does that mean for you? When I'm vindicated before God, you who have persecuted me will surely be condemned by God. And there's a foretaste of that within the book itself. Not the final judgment, but you know, right at the end of the book, Job is vindicated and his friends are condemned. So Job's faith shines sporadically through in the book, but the flashes get stronger as the trial of his faith proceeds, even as 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 7, that the trial of your faith, being much more precious than of gold that perisheth, though it be tried with fire, might be found unto praise and honor and glory at the appearing of Jesus Christ.